This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's Monday, May 6th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Donald Trump hit with a $1,000 fine trying to shut him up. I don't think it'll work. I say this because of the 9 previous $1,000 fines to shut him up. Didn't seem to have the desired effect. I don't think Donald Trump has a $10,000 threshold for this one. I mean, we're talking about a guy who spent $60,000 on a garish oil painting of him, or as he saw it, an accurate and heroic oil painting of him. To be fair, Michael Cohen told Congress that that purchase was made vis-a-vis a fake buyer fronting for the Trump Foundation. So it's out of his pocket. It's really pennies. This fine, the $1,000 fine, will not keep First Amendment scholars from getting their full night's sleep, I don't believe. It concerned Trump's complaining about his jury during a telephone interview with the far-right media outlet Real America's Voice, the voice being delivered via a phone line in this particular case. And the opinion was not just costly, but I have to say, strategically questionable if Donald Trump is actually looking for an acquittal, bitching about the jury in public. I'm seriously beginning to doubt that he is looking for an acquittal. And so you have to ask, what kind of fine will shut him up? Well, we have an idea of the market for silence in the Donald Trump orbit. This very trial is about the $130 hush payments he made to Stormy Daniels, allegedly, or maybe in a couple weeks, factually. American Media Inc., the publisher of the National Enquirer, also paid Karen McDougal $150,000 not to speak. So $150,000 in 2016, you know, and adjusted for inflation, that's about $194,000 today. Would, let's round up, $200,000 buy Donald Trump's silence? No, I don't think so. But we're never really going to know because Judge Juan Merchan can only fine at $1,000 a pop, and Trump does tend to pop off. $1,000 a max. Well, that's a monetary fine. The judge also said today, quote, "It appears that the $1,000 fines are not serving as a deterrent. Therefore, going forward, this court will have to consider a jail sanction. I do not want to impose a jail sanction and have done everything I can to avoid doing so, but I will if necessary." Reuters, in an article that contains some of those quotes, explains that, quote, "Imprisonment would be an unprecedented step in the historic trial." As if it's anything other than unprecedented to see a former president forking over 10 large on the regular as the price of doing business, business defined as buying off a porn star. But I'm telling you, I think the man is Brer Rabbiting things. I don't think he really wants to avoid jail. Situation developing. On the show today, an excellent interview that I read and we'll talk to you about in Semaphore with the executive editor of the New York Times. Joe Kahn wants his paper to faithfully report the news. Well, doesn't every paper? No, actually not. But first, it is time. It's happened. You knew it would occur. We talk about big issues. We talk about worldly issues. We often stay in this hemisphere. Not today. It's time for Koala Talk. Once every other season, The Gist chats about everything koala. Today, we're joined by Danielle Claude. She has written a book, the book, shall we say, on koalas. And I have questions for her about our favorite, one of our favorites, among our favorite smushy-nosed marsupials, Danielle Claude, up next. A lot of times when you hear about VPNs, I find that they just assume you know what they are, or even if you have an understanding, oh, they're a virtual private network, you might not know the acronym, but in general, don't they mask what you do online? Why do I need that? People don't explain it correctly, and it was explained to me when I got into the beneficial aspects of Surfshark. So a VPN does mask what you do online, and that's really important for some people who, you know, might be trying to be a dissident in an oppressive regime. It's also just important in terms of general hygiene for why do you have to let every advertiser and everyone else know where you were and, you know, follow your tracks. But I find it's also very practical. Like I said, it's a mask, and so a mask does hide identity, but a mask, a well-fitted N95 mask, also might protect you, which is what a VPN does too. Practically, however, in my life, there are many websites that when I'm traveling, I can access. I have and pay for access to them. Then I find myself in as far-flung a place as Canada. Sometimes, as an American, a foreign version of, say, Netflix would come in handy. I'd like to watch some of those shows, and I'm not just talking about Czechoslovak soap operas. I'm talking about how the excellent movies move in and out of the different Netflix in different localities. With a really good VPN like Surfshark, you could access all of them. And another big one for me is there is a major broadcaster in Britain. It is a broadcasting company there, but they don't let me hear all the stuff that someone there can hear. With a VPN, I could listen to that as if I were there. There are so many practical uses, plus the traditional use of why let them know exactly what you're doing. Your surfing is for you. A VPN allows you to surf what you want to surf, where you want to surf, without interference from, let's say, repressive governments or the Czech Netflix regime. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. What are those deals? Well, enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/gist.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to Koala Talk. I assume you have many questions about koala, and in this segment, we have all your koala questions answered. Danielle Claude is a koala expert. She's from Madagascar. No, I'm kidding. She's, of course, from Australia. She's the author of the new book, Koala, A Natural History and an Uncertain Future. And on the cover, and this is excellent marketing, just the most adorable picture of a koala and a koala baby looking right at the camera with those cute little noses. We're going to talk about that. It's very offensive to a koala expert to talk about how cute they are. But I do wonder, and Danielle, welcome to the gist. I'll start off by saying, was your initial interest in koalas, would you cop to the fact that they are kind of cute?
Yeah, they certainly are cute. And that's one of the great appeals of koalas, is just how attached people are to them. They just elicit such a strong emotional response. It's really fascinating.
And did you give me your story as a young koala enthusiast, and you turned it into a career as a scientist? What made you make the leap?
Well, really, I wouldn't count myself as a koala expert, really, although I obviously know a lot about them, having written a book about them. Koalas for Australians are just sort of part of the landscape, you know. They're always interesting and fun to see, and people love spotting them, but they're around, and especially where I live in the Adelaide Hills, they're quite abundant. So we see them, you know, from time to time wandering down the road or in a tree, or you hear them bellowing in the forest during the mating season. So they're just, you know, kind of part of the landscape, and you don't think too much about them. But when I actually started thinking about them, I thought, well, you know, there's a lot more to these animals than a pretty face. So I really wanted to find out more about them, and so I decided to get in touch with some of my colleagues who are real koala experts and learn from them.
So you say bellowing. Is that your term, your authorial term, or is this the word we use for the koala cry, a bellow?
It is the word we use, yes. There are less attractive words to use for the noise. Some people say it sounds like a donkey braying, or a pig, or a truck, a chainsaw. It's kind of similar to that. It's like a wheezy cry, but it is a bellow. I think that's fair.
The wheezy cry of the koala. And could you approximate that for us now? No, I'm joking. You don't have to.
Well, I can tell you how to do it.
Yeah, got it.
You can, if you pretend to be a donkey and make the classic Eeyore noise, make that as deep as you possibly can and then slow it right down to, you know, a half speed. That, and then sort of just fade it out at the end like you've run out of breath. That's what a koala bellow sounds like.
Okay, let me try it now. And then what we're going to do on the show is we'll cut in an actual koala sound, okay?
That'll be a That's good probably idea. A good idea.
So you did mention around where you live, and give us a sense where that is. There are so many of these koalas, but we always hear, and you address this in the book, you say they're certainly not as abundant as all the kangaroos, places lousy with kangaroos, but... I do hear Americans who are taken by the koala always hears how close to extinction or how tenuous their continued existence is. But is that quite true?
Yeah, look, it is and it isn't, I guess. The interesting thing, koalas are a very widespread species in Australia. So they're found all along the east coast and down the south, a bit around the south coast, everywhere there's forests, really, on the mainland. And they're widespread, but they're not common. So they're a sparsely distributed species. So there's not like kangaroos, which are, there's lots of them in it, lots of places. So in that sense, their population is hard to track, they're hard to find, and it's hard to know exactly how many there are. But what we do know is that on the east coast of Australia, what we might call their heartland, they are declining, and they're declining quite rapidly. So that's the reason for concern. However, in other parts of the country, particularly along the south coast, they've actually made a remarkable recovery, and they're very dense in some places, particularly where I live in the Adelaide Hills, which is at the westerly end of their range. But they're in very, very small pockets of forest, so they're very, very vulnerable to bushfires in particular, as well as other things like diseases.
Is deforestation and the loss of their natural habitat, is that the biggest threat to koalas?
It's certainly a major factor in the ongoing decline of koalas on the east coast. So those areas are known to be, you know, they're really a bit of a hotspot, sadly, for land clearance. So despite the fact that we're supposed to be protecting our native forests and not clearing any more of them, they are still being cleared because there are exemptions for agriculture, for mining, and also for development. We seem, you know, the koalas are living in areas that are highly favoured by humans as well. So we see a lot of those areas slowly get eroded away. And, you know, developments like roads are enormous barriers to koalas. A lot of koalas die on the road. And every time you put a road through an area, you're cutting off the koalas from their ability to survive in the landscape.
Do Australians care, or are they so inured to the presence of koalas? Or maybe, I think this is true with kangaroos, they consider them pests.
No, Australians do care deeply about koalas. It's a huge public concern that they're going extinct, declining, I should say.
Yes.
They're not at risk immediately of going extinct, but certainly that they're declining, or local populations are going extinct would be the correct thing to say. So there's a lot of public concern, but, you know, there are very powerful interest groups who continue to benefit from land clearance, and there's a conflict between human populations and koala populations that's not yet adequately resolved in some areas.
And then what about the wildfires that hit Australia or have been hitting Australia? I've actually done some segments on the show. There is a lot of concern with this in terms of koala habitat, right?
Yeah, well, because we've got reduced areas of forest that the koalas have to have to survive, they can't live anywhere else except in good, you know, reasonably good quality native forests. Those small patches of forest are also highly flammable. So the trees that the koalas eat are eucalypts, and they're uniquely specialised for those trees. But those trees are also highly flammable. And when they, you know, when fires come through, the forests burn quite fiercely, and the koalas really have no way of escaping that. So, and the smaller the forests are, the more likely it is that the koalas don't have anywhere to go. You know, there's no it limits the ability of the koalas to recover in areas. So the isolated forests are much more difficult for koalas to come in from neighbouring forests that weren't burnt. And when we saw the big Black Summer fires that burnt right down the east coast, that impacted a lot of areas and areas that hadn't previously ever been burnt. So, you know, climate change is definitely altering the pattern of burning, and we're now losing areas that are highly fire sensitive. So those things are a problem. We saw a big fire in Kangaroo Island, which was one of the densest populations of koalas in the country. It's in South Australia where I live, and it's kind of a sanctuary for koalas. And we lost 40,000 koalas in one fire.
Kangaroo Island's a sanctuary for koalas?
Well, yes, koalas were repopulated on it. They disappeared from there thousands of years ago, but they were repopulated onto the island as a safety mechanism because people were worried about them going extinct in the 1930s. So they were established on that island, and they've done extremely well. It's a very safe place for them. It's a big area of forest, and there was a big population there, but it's been pretty much demolished by the fire that burnt through that park.
Yeah. And then there are the natural predators. And of course, as man-made incursions affect ecosystems, things can come out of balance. But I wouldn't say I enjoyed, but I started thinking about the idea of a giant owl swooping out of the sky and eating a koala. It never occurred to me before your book. Have you seen it? Is there footage of such a thing?
I have not actually seen any footage of birds of prey taking koalas, but we know that they do. There's some biologists who were studying a powerful owl nest, which is the largest owl in Australia, and that pair of owls was...
I mean, that's the name of the species, the powerful owls.
The powerful owl, that's right.
That's the name of my fantasy, the Australian rules football team, but sorry, go ahead.
Well, they're not as big as the wedge-tailed eagle, which is our largest eagle, and that's a really super impressive bird.
There's another fascinating aspect of koaladom, which is that I think the vast majority of people love them and find them cute, but then there's the contrarian take that I think you put your finger on this. It overemphasizes some of their negative characteristics. So they're supposed to be very nasty, according to the more, actually, koala gang. They're supposed to be very nasty, and then we could get into their intelligence or brain size. But are we implying human characteristics? Are we being anthropocentric about koalas when we call them nasty? Or do they have a fine demeanor in the wild?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of myths around koalas. The idea that koalas are stupid is, you know, it's not really accurate. I mean, it comes from the idea that, you know, they sleep a lot. Koalas spend 90% of their time asleep in the trees. And, you know, people have hypothesized that that's because they're eating toxic eucalypt leaves, and the toxins in the eucalypts have damaged their brain, and, you know, they're basically stoned, none of which is true at all. They're sleeping up there because they can, because they're safe in the trees, they've got a full tummy, and they have nothing better to do than sit back and digest their meal. So they don't need to be on alert for predators, because the best thing they can do is stay still. And they don't need to run away from anything, and they've got all their food around them. So really, they sleep because that's the best strategy for them, not because they're stupid. They might have a limited behavioural repertoire, but it doesn't mean they're not capable of quite complex thought processes. But people don't really study koalas. It's hard to study a koala when they're only awake for an hour or two a day. So it makes your studies really difficult.
Vanna White has a limited repertoire, and she's made millions. That's an American joke. I don't expect you to get it. But apply it to whatever Australian celebrity on your version of Wheel of Fortune turns the
letters. Yeah, for sure, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure koalas would be fairly unimpressed with our behavioural activities as well. We're always asleep when they're looking at what we're doing. So we're just on the other time scale, aren't they? You know, when they're active at night and we're active during the day. And I guess the issue about them being a nasty animal or an aggressive animal, there's really a bit of a joke, I guess, because they are a very amiable animal. They can bite, and they can certainly scratch. They've got formidable claws. But given how well-equipped they are, they're actually fairly amiable most of the time, unless you're doing something with them that they don't appreciate. They're not aggressive animals. There are some funny videos online of koalas chasing people on trail bikes or quad bikes. That is because they think there's another koala there. The quad bike does sound a lot like a koala bellowing. So that's, you know, perhaps one of the things that might make people think they're not all that bright.
Koalas are marsupials. I learned a lot about marsupials. Like, there's a lion marsupial. I don't know how lion-esque it is. But as a marsupial, they're not bears. Do they benefit or are they hurt by the misimpression that they're part of the bear family?
Oh, yeah. Look, I guess the bear connection probably more does come from the fact that they, you know, climb trees. So people used to call them, when they first encountered koalas, Europeans thought that they were sloths or monkeys or bears because they're something very distinct and very different. So marsupials are very characteristic of Australian fauna. So marsupials are more familiar to us than a lot of placental mammals that the rest of the world has. But I think that there is a bit of bias towards marsupials just simply because they're uncommon in the Northern Hemisphere. So they're unfamiliar and people tend to put down things that they're unfamiliar with. So marsupials mm-hmm. get a bad rap in science as well as in popular opinion. And I think koalas suffer from that a little bit too.
Yeah. Also, I think the names of many a marsupial makes them the source of, I don't know, derision, certainly folly. There's the bandicoot. There's the kangaroo. There is the potoroo. I mean, I don't know how all these marsupials get their names, but they don't seem very serious, proper Victorian animals.
Yeah, no. A lot of them are based on indigenous names, so some of them have their origins in the local indigenous names for the species, which gives them they've got beautiful musical names, in fact, and that's a very characteristic thing of a lot of indigenous languages that has all those repeated vowels and things.
Exactly.
So that's a very characteristic thing in Australia. Place names, we have a lot of those, like Woolloomooloo and those sorts of places.
Yes. I mean, imagine playing, what's the name of that place?
Woolloomooloo.
Willamaloo. Imagine playing a didgeridoo in Willamaloo while a potoroo dances nearby. That vacation can be yours for $5,000 or 8,000 Australian. But about their brains, you talk to an expert who prints out a graph of where the brains are in terms of size, and they're right in a proper percentile for their skull shape and for their body size. I did find out from your book that it was the rare North American marsupial, the Virginia possum, who is, I'm not going to say dumbest, but has the smallest brain per skull capacity, that maybe gives rise to the idea that marsupials aren't that smart. And it's not even from the land of marsupials that this laggard of a marsupial exists.
That's right. There's a lot of marsupials in South America. So the South American opossums are a big family of marsupials as well. They're very much a Gondwanan feature. So South America and Australia have a lot of marsupials. But, you know, we shouldn't put too much store on brain size anyway. There's plenty of animals that are incredibly smart with relatively small brains, and birds are a great example of that. They can outperform most of the primates on lots of things with relatively small brains. So, you know, it's not how big your brain is, it's really what you do with it.
Danielle Claude's area of expertise, among her areas of expertise, are that cute little marsupial whose brain is perfectly situated on the graph of where the brain should be, the koala. You might pick up her book with the subtitle A Natural History in an Uncertain Future. It's called Other Things in Other Formats. Danielle, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee, But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Hi, I'm Mike Pesca, and I'm in the truth and facts business. All right, I'm in the opinion journalism as guided by truth and facts business. Who would say they weren't? I mean, I'm sure some gamers and guys on Twitch, but who talks into a microphone or writes on Substack or puts pen to paper, quill to parchment, would argue I do something other than truth and facts and trying to convince you? Well, they wouldn't say it so directly, but what they would say and what they do say is, truth, there is no one truth. We have many truths. Well, I've considered that, I understand what they're saying, and I understand what they're not saying, and I reject it. There is an entire debate that I've talked about, maybe ad nauseum, to your ears about objectivity. But today, in the publication Semaphore, Ben Smith did a very useful interview with Joe Kahn, who's the editor of the New York Times. And he said, Kahn did, that the role of the news media is not to skew your coverage towards one candidate or the other, but just to provide good, hard-hitting, well-rounded coverage of both candidates informing voters. Which seems anodyne, except since this was done in service of the question, why don't you see your job as we've got to stop Trump? Many people said that should be your job. Many people who are supposed experts on journalism. Jay Rosen, an NYU professor who seems to hate the free exchange of ideas. One of his big ideas was to censor Donald Trump from doing nightly COVID briefings, which I believe were a key to his undoing, by the way, but Rosen wanted to keep the public from those briefings. So Jay Rosen came out criticizing this. A guy named Dan Frumkin, who is consistently on the wrong side of liberty and speech issues because he thinks that our country is about to collapse under the weight of anti-democratic forces. And so we've got to preach and present our coverage that concentrates on that. He came out against it. Even a guy I love, or used to love, but could still love, Norman Ornstein of AEI, criticized this as either reading the polls or not doing your job as a journalist. So Joe Kahn is right. Everything he's saying is correct. Everyone who runs a newspaper or a real big news organization that seeks to be credible should agree with this way of looking at the world. Our job is not to tell voters, not to tell citizens who to vote for. It's to give them the information with which they can make their own decision. And yeah, I'll co-sign to the idea that that decision, if it were Donald Trump, would be a destructive decision to America. But that's not how a newspaper, that's not how a news organization should do the job. Later in the interview, he says a line that probably doesn't gain much notice, saying that their job is to commit themselves to the idea of independent journalism. This seems like a collection of words that any journalistic organization, real or imaginary, which is to say, from CNN to MSNBC to Fox to OAN, they could claim the mantle of independent journalism. But if you don't know how to read the tea leaves of the New York Times, and that's fine, you should just be reading the New York Times and not the tea leaves thereof. It's a meaningful phrase because the publisher of the New York Times, A.G. Sulzberger, has defined the mission as independent journalism by his actions, but also directly in an essay in the Columbia Journalism Review. He talked about the idea of objectivity, and he was savvy enough and knew enough not to embrace the actual word objectivity, but he embraced the ideal of of objectivity. He rebranded this as fairness and independent journalism. The words, and we live in a world of word wars, the words are contested, but the idea is clear. It is that the New York Times, like me, like I said at the top of this segment, is in the fact and truth game. Now, it's really important that you should know, and Jay Rose and Dan Frumpkin and others do a service in that they say there are others who object to this as their mission. But I need you to know, I want you to know, that there are many other major news organizations, maybe news organizations that you trust, that are actually on the other side of that divide. They do not believe in truth, a truth, or the truth. This has become a more popular idea in recent years, but it is a prevalent idea in places like the LA Times. And I don't know exactly why they changed, but that is a news organization that doesn't believe in objective journalism as a phrase. And from so much of what I've read, has largely eschewed that as an ideal. Then I come to the Philadelphia Inquirer. So the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a headline on June 2nd of 2020, Buildings Matter Too. They can be rebuilt while lives are forever lost, but that doesn't mean they will be. It was, of course, about the rioting and protests and looting. The editor who okayed or constructed this headline was fired, decided to quit. And then the Philadelphia Inquirer did a huge bit of soul searching in which they hired a journalist, a celebrated journalist named Wesley Lowery, to go over their entire history and to excoriate the newspaper. Part of Lowery's findings, which were a huge series looking over how racist the paper was in the 1980s and bringing that up to today, the Philadelphia Inquirer itself writes of a quote and slogan central to the Inquirer as a through line, juxtaposing those words against the paper's history and its current mission to be an anti-racist newsroom. In 2020, the Inquirer promised change after facing widespread scrutiny for publishing the racist headline, Buildings Matter Too. They say four or five times in that self-flagellating report that Buildings Matter Too was a racist headline. They needed to do some self-examination and they needed to commit to the project of anti-racism. Friends, this is something other than the project of objectivity. Not just that assailed word, but the project of being in the truth and facts game. To be in the game of having an anti-racist newsroom is to jettison the ideas of objectivity as has served the news industry for many years. And my point here is to say that the New York Times is on the one side of this divide, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, which will probably endorse all the same candidates for national office, which certainly has many columnists with overlapping opinions and whose editorial pages are probably the same as the New York Times, but they believe in doing news a different way. They hired Wesley Lowery, a guy who wrote an op-ed, has written a lot about the bad idea of objectivity. Lowery writes, neutral objectivity trips over itself to find ways to avoid telling the truth. There is objectivity and there is truth, and objectivity is the enemy of truth. That is this framing. That is the way to look at the news business from one side of the coin, which is the opposite of the New York Times side of the coin. Lowery goes on to write, the mainstream has allowed what it considers objective truth to be decided almost exclusively by white reporters and their mostly white bosses, calibrated to avoid offending the sensibility of white readers. The views and inclinations of whiteness are accepted as the objective neutral. And he goes on to write, conversations about objectivity rather than happening in a virtuous vacuum habitually focus on predicting whether a given sentence will appear objective to a reader who is assumed to be white. Lowery is very much concerned with whiteness, the idea of whiteness, the ill-defined but certainly boogeyman-esque idea of whiteness, and it informs his journalism, which is fine, which is not an objective journalism, he would proudly say. And it informs places like the Philadelphia Inquirer, which hire him to do a careful vetting of its history. You could also say to absolve it of its sins. But they do not inform the New York Times. And I know this from reading the New York Times, and I know this from observing the hiring practices of the New York Times. I know this because the leaders of the New York Times look back to 2020 and the firing of their op-ed page editor, James Bennett, and I don't think they could admit this for personnel reasons, but they regret how that was handled. They probably regret the fact that Bennett was fired. And they might even regret the fact that they gave an op-ed slot to Wesley Lowery. That is where all those quotes from Wesley Lowery originate. A June 23rd, 2020 op-ed in the New York Times, a reckoning over objectivity led by black journalists. Black journalists were central to that. The idea of whiteness was pilloried, prodded, poked, discarded. And that did happen in 2020. And now in 2024, the New York Times is saying, we've considered all that. We probably don't regret hearing out the side of the anti-objectivity brigades, but we are in the objectivity business once again. We're not going to call it that because we're savvy, but we're in the business of providing readers what they need in order to make decisions, not trying to predetermine the decision and make it for them, which brings me to NPR, because I am very worried about NPR. And for all the excesses or, to me, quirks of NPR when I worked there, they were more or less in the objectivity business. We all knew that different people have different perspectives, and I think we were very eager to pursue many of those perspectives. But the idea that there was no truth, the postmodern idea that your truth is just as good as my truth, which opened the door to white truth has dominated all other truths, that was not prevalent in the 10 years that I worked there 10 years ago. I do not know if it will be prevalent in the future. I do know that their CEO, Catherine Marr, is being called before Congress to talk about this and other issues. And I know that Catherine Marr, in her TED talk, was on the record as questioning the wisdom of the facts and truth business.
One of the things that we could all acknowledge is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths.
So that was from a TED Talk. I think we played it on the show before when she was talking as from her perspective as CEO of the Wikipedia Foundation. You can extrapolate from that more than is factual and more than is truthful. Maybe Wikipedia is fine to orient, or they were fine to orient themselves with that mindset. But combine that with some other comments she's made about how the First Amendment is a problem in combating disinformation. Combine that with dozens of tweets she's issued reflecting a social activist and, sorry, postmodern view of truth. And combine that with tweets literally skeptical of the idea of objectivity. I'm wondering where NPR is and where they were going. For a long time, I worked on a show called On the Media. It was pretty much settled, and I learned and understood most of what I came to understand about the idea of objectivity. Flawed, impossible idea. Fairness, factualness is a better way to frame it. Now, On the Media has done many segments with Wesley Lowery and other types who are very keen on jettisoning the idea of objectivity. NPR itself has done, and I've played you on this show, many segments questioning, prodding, and not really in any way defending the idea of objectivity. I wonder how explicitly, or really this is what matters, implicitly, NPR will continue to be an objective news organization. Now, you might say, continue to be. Well, do what the New York Times has done. Reclaim its role as an objective news organization. You don't have to call yourself that, but it's good to have it as an internal guidelight, a lodestar, or, if you will, a North Star. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson is the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomperoo-gee-peroo-doo-peroo. Thanks for listening.
In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done.